been a privilege to have Prince Mashele as a South African starting point. It's also been a privilege to have him at BizNews conference here in March and to bring him back again by popular demand to the discussions today, where I'm sure that you will be provided with enlightenment in an area that perhaps you aren't as well exposed to. He's one of the sharpest and most influential voices in South African political analysis. He's written books, he's a historian, he's written columns, and he provides a clarity always in his writing. You know, I'm a writer to start with. I've done broadcasting mostly because BizNews is now 85% a broadcaster. But if you're a writer, you know good writing. And this man can write. Read his stuff. It's clear. It's concise. There's no fluff. There's no, well, you know, we need to get a book out this month. Here, let's just get some guy to push it through the process and use a bit of AI. That's not Prince. That's not Prince at all. He is a prince amongst writers as well. His powerful perspective, though, wasn't only shaped in lecture halls of universities for a crucial period. He worked inside the very heart of government in South Africa as a speechwriter in the presidency under former President Thabo Mbeki. This rare experience gave me an insider view of how power actually operates, how decisions are made here in South Africa, and how official narratives are crafted. A perspective that gives his analysis today a unique and formidable edge. He hasn't just studied politics from the outside. He hasn't just learnt about it through history. He's seen it from the inside out. Please welcome a man with the ultimate insider's perspective, Prince Mashele.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.
You know, Alec always oversells me. I don't know why. So let me apologize in advance if I disappoint you. Let me start with a conclusion, which is that we are lucky and unlucky, depending on how you look at it, to live today. Why? Because we are witnessing the unfolding of an important moment in history. We may not be aware of it, but we are. History happens on two planes, only two planes. On an international plane or a domestic plane. There is nowhere else you're going to experience history, either through international events or domestic events. Internationally, we are going through the collapse of the transatlantic security arrangement, which emerged after the Second World War. That undergirded global security and relative political stability from 1945 to where we are. That arrangement is crumbling as we speak. The second aspect of the international historic moment is the discrediting of democracy as a model of governing human affairs. Very worrying. Look around the world. And these two things internationally, the security arrangement as well as democracy, were underwritten and championed by what we call the West. The West is no longer, as we speak, a model when it comes to do these two things. In the main, It's because the big brother who anchored these two things has gone mad. And that's the US. Completely gone mad. And you see, the madness of the US is not one guy, Trump, is the society itself. The Americans, the way they hate each other, they can no longer have a civilized conversation with each other. And therefore can no longer project leadership in the world. That's enough about the outside, the international plane of history. I'm here to talk about the domestic plane, because that's where we are. We can find a time in somewhere in the future to talk in detail about the international plane. So we're lucky and or unlucky to witness what we're witnessing international, but let's park it there. Let's come to the domestic plane. We are also going through a historic moment domestically. We may or may not be aware of it. For 76 years, South Africa has been governed by two political parties. If you want to borrow from Gramsci, you could say hegemonic forces. The first hegemonic force was the Afrikaner nationalists. Took over the reins of the country in 1948, all the way to 1994. There was a time when those guys were so much in charge that people could not imagine that the end would come. So much so that Oliver Tambo, when he was told, was in London, that an announcement has been made in South Africa to release Mandela, he actually didn't believe it. He could not, he spent his life fighting the apartheid, he could not believe it. But that was the end of a hegemonic force that held society together. And then the ANC took over. We have now reached the end of the ANC as a hegemonic force, but also as a government of South Africa. That's huge. It's massive. It's not small. People don't want to see it and they don't want to believe it. And when I have been saying it, they think that I smoke marijuana. I've never smoked, but it's legal even if I smoke. We have reached the end of the African National Congress as the government of South Africa. This is what happens when you get to that point where a hegemonic force exits this stage. There's anxiety and there's uncertainty about the future. Show me one individual in this room who is not anxious and who is not uncertain about the future. Just one. Raise up your hand. So you see, I know you. Now, when the ANC is a liberation movement, and we can go back to history and look at examples of liberation movements, how they perform. When liberation movements reach this point that we have reached, they do either of two things. One, they resist, take up arms, terrorize everyone, and prolong their stay in power. Example, Zimbabwe. Or, secondly, they loot because they know these are last days, so let's loot. Example, the African National Congress in South Africa. These fellows, ladies and gentlemen, are busy looting like you cannot imagine. As we speak, you're at a conference, they are looting outside. But you see, you must understand their nature of looting. How are they looting? They are not looting collectively. They are looting individually. By the way, they no longer even give money to their part themselves. No. No, they don't give money to their party. No. They stuff their pockets. They are thinking of their children. These are the last days. I'll no longer be a minister. Let me loot so that I'm sorted when we are out. That's what is happening. And by the way, that kind of looting, towards the end, I'll address it. It's actually very... It's fortunate for us that are looting that way, because at some point we'll collect them and lock them up. And there will be no collective defense, because they didn't tell each other that, comrade, let's loot. That moment will come. They will go to jail. Watch, mark my words. So that's the first point I wanted to make, is that we need to understand the bigger picture of what is going on, which is we're going through the processing out of a liberation movement from power. They cannot resist, the African National Congress. Why? Because they don't control South Africa. The ANC does not control South Africa. Most people don't get it. They think the ANC controls everything. No, no, no. They've never controlled in everything. There's a book by Moises Naim. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this. End of Power. Just read that book. This idea, conception of power as a centralized phenomenon, where there's a statesman sitting somewhere instructing how a society must unfold. Naim says, no, 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 no. That has come to an end. There are pockets of entities in society that have pockets of power. If you look at ZANU-PF, ZANU-PF historically has been a military organization. And the military organizations work through a command and control system. The guy at the top commands, and everyone who's down there acts according to instructions, not the ANC. The ANC can command and things don't happen according to their command. So we're lucky. Okay, so that's the first point about the bigger picture. Let me come to the second point. The second point is, what happens? Because you see, so the ANC is out. What happens in the interregnum? The interregnum, because if you go back, you would say, this is how South Africa has been working. There's one dominant party after another for 76 years. So logic would be, after this dominant party is out, another one will come and occupy the vacuum. That is the logic. If we operate on the basis of what has been happening over the past 76 years, there is no dominant party that is going to take over South Africa over the next minimum 15 years. None. Not one single party will win the elections and cross the 51% mark over at least 15 years. Live and I live. So the interregnum will be chaotic. Coalition governments of one kind or the other. You may ask, what about the DA? What about this and that? And next year's elections. And I follow the polls and all of that stuff. The fastest growing political party in South Africa is Umkhonto we Sizwe. It's not the DA. Just look at the numbers. umkhonto wesizwe. So I hear the talk about the DA, this doing well. This, the fastest growing party in South Africa is umkhonto wesizwe. And in fact, just to burst the DA's bubble in the Western Cape, I mean, I'm very brave. If you look at the growth of the DA vis-a-vis ANC, the EFF, and umkhonto wesizwe, you can see that the DA is actually stuck. Yeah, take the ANC, take the EFF, take umkhonto wesizwe. I mean, remember, these three are actually the same thing. The DA is stuck. It's no longer, it came fast, but it's stuck around the lower 20s. I don't see the DA actually breaking out of that. And I'll explain why. So we are going to have coalition governments for 15 years. Watching my time. The third point, which is my last point, and I want to spend my next 6 minutes on this one. It's how do you rescue South Africa? Can South Africa be rescued? Solutions. South Africa can be rescued, and it's actually very easy to rescue this thing. You know, I had a conversation with an intellectual friend of mine the other day. He said, oh, it would be difficult to turn South Africa around. I said, my goodness, you crazy. Look at China. I said, how many human beings are there in China? 1.4 billion. How many human beings are in South Africa? About 61, 65 million. It's a neighborhood. If you think of South Africa versus China, it's just a neighborhood. So you can't turn around a neighborhood like this. I mean, those who have gone to China, just go to their cities. When you come back, you're embarrassed to call Johannesburg a city. And look at what they've done in 45 years. That thing was a third world country backward. They were wearing pajamas during the day, riding bicycles all over. But look at what they have done. And the scripts are there in terms of how they've done it. Read Ezra Vogel, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, step by step how they did it. Read from Third World to First World, Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. Step by step, how do you change a country? This thing, it's a neighborhood, you can turn it around. And I've had drops saying, give it to me in a year. This thing can be turned around in a very short space of time. What are the elements? One, leadership. We need to come up with a formula for political leadership. And here, I'll state my colors. This is one of the things that I have learned. Almost every week, I'm all over the country speaking to different people, whites, blacks, colors. There's something I have come to learn about South Africa. Is this, that South Africans, whites and blacks, don't talk to each other. It's the biggest weakness of our politics, of our society. We don't talk to each other. Blacks, I address their conferences. Only blacks. Whites, I address their conferences like this. Only whites. Indians, I address their conferences. I'm thinking, hey, what's going on here? We've got to break that stuff. We've got to break that stuff. Even historically, if you who are obsessed with history, the Afrikaners and the English butchered each other until they realized, fellows, let's come together. They went to Vereeniging. They said, we can only govern this thing properly if we do it together. And look at what they have done collectively, by the way, since 1910 all the way to 1994, and the achievements they have made, even in terms of ending poverty among themselves. So we've reached a point where we have to come together, black, whites, and learn to talk to each other. And that discussion, by the way, needs to be led by the best among us. The most educated and the most gifted among whites, the most educated and the most gifted among blacks. Somebody somewhere must start that process. It doesn't have to be a huge jamboree at UNISA. Second element is crime. If we don't deal with crime, nothing in South Africa will work. South Africa has now been turned into a gangster paradise. The criminals and politicians, especially on the ANC side of things, can no longer be differentiated. So we need to deal with crime. So this group of elites who must talk and say, guys, what do we do with our country? First priority, crime. The third is education. And here I'm going to emphasize the education of black people. White people, generally, you guys have well-functioning schools in the private space. Nobody must touch your schools, by the way, and mess them up. Because we are lucky to have those schools that are functioning here in South Africa. If we didn't have them, we'd have to travel outside South Africa to go and learn how does a school work. So we don't need to go out of South Africa. The schools are here. They work. And kudos to Kuro, by the way. My firstborn goes to Kuro. So we've got to address the education of black people. And public schools, by the way. Show me one country that has developed on the basis of private education in the world. West, East, you will struggle to find one. So public education. I'm watching my minute. The third is infrastructure. This is the easiest to fix. I mean, really, a road. Look at the Western Cape. I mean, I've been driving around here, no potholes. It's the easiest to fix. So we didn't spend a second on that because you guys here, I'm sure, you can fix our infrastructure. And the last is we must preach this, the market economy combined with a competent state. The state must be competent, but the private sector must be allowed to thrive. Example of that, here in the Western Cape, the state is competent. It is a competent state. You can see it. And the private sector is thriving. So that's the gist of what I wanted to say. But I know there are questions, and Alec has always been good in probing. And thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.